Det är tisdagen den 11 november. Jag heter Tove Livendal och du lyssnar på Ledarredaktionen, en podd från Svenska Dagbladet. Välkommen! Today's episode will be held in English. On October 7, 2023, Hamas attacked Israel and forced the country into war. Since then, a lot has happened and the world has not been the same, not even in Sweden. We will talk about that today with my guest Ziv Nevo-Kullman, ambassador to Sweden from Israel. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming here. How do you describe the situation now regarding the ceasefire and expectations for what will happen going forward?
Well, we've said all along since October 7th that the war could end immediately once Hamas releases the Israeli hostages and gives up its military power in Gaza. So what we see now that has happened over the last month is that most of the hostages came back. As we speak, bodies of hostages are still being kept by Hamas and other terrorist groups. And the question remains, will Hamas give up its military grip of Gaza as it has to do according to the ceasefire agreement?
And what are the critical issues? We've seen bloody power struggles have erupted in Gaza between Hamas and various clans. What does the outcome of those battles mean?
So the critical issue, of course, is compliance, whether Hamas complies with the agreement that it signed. Not all the hostages, as I've mentioned, not all the hostages are back. This is why I'm still wearing the yellow ribbon pin, because I will wear it until all of the hostages return. But it's also the question what Hamas does the day after. It's been shooting people around Gaza. It doesn't look like someone who is about to give up power. And it's important that the countries that guarantee the ceasefire agreement, the countries that have helped in the negotiations, of course, the United States, but also Egypt, Qatar, and Turkey, put pressure on Hamas to make sure that it complies with the ceasefire agreement. We hope that the ceasefire will hold, because that is the key for the demilitarization and the de-radicalization of the Gaza Strip.
Do we know if there are internal disagreements within Hamas or how to, react to the situation forward, and if there are those willing to give up their power, or, those who persist on remain in charge?
They signed an agreement and they have to comply with this agreement. And as I said, it's the way they've been acting in Gaza, killing Palestinian civilians in the street, doesn't look like people who are about to give up power. Also, we have seen, I've mentioned the fact that not all hostages are back, which is in compliance with the ceasefire agreement, but also the fact that Hamas militants came out of tunnels and attacked and killed three Israeli soldiers in different incidents since the ceasefire agreement was signed. So the situation on the ground is still very volatile, and we hope with all of our hearts that the ceasefire agreement will hold.
One thing that we always talk about in the Western debate is the two-state solution. Do you think it is possible?
Well, to have a two-state solution, you need to have a partner. It takes two to tango. Hamas obviously is not interested in the two-state solution. We've seen what it's capable of on October 7th. Its charter, it still calls for the destruction of the state of Israel. The Palestinian Authority hasn't had elections in so many years, and the latest polls show that if they had fair and open elections, Hamas would take over. So I think we need to focus on cooperation in the region, maybe in the form of the Abraham Accords, something that is for the benefit of all sides, and hope for one day that there will be a possibility that there will be a partner, because Israelis and Palestinians should live side by side peacefully.
And when we talk about future, could you even, think of what kind of time frame we are talking about for finding such a partner?
Right now, the Middle East is not in a good shape. We're after 2 years of war. Hamas. I mean, you see what kind of destruction they brought on us, and what kind of destruction was brought on Gaza because of the way Hamas hid behind its own population. The healing is going to take some time, and we need to build up trust. And building up trust can take years. What President Trump is talking about in the ceasefire agreement, but also in the Sharm el-Sheikh in the summit, is talking about forming a group of countries, the Abraham Accord countries, that actually want to cooperate with Israel on things that have to do about, you know, civilian life, about climate, about things that are going to make life in the region better for everyone. And I think this is a pragmatic way of looking at the near future.
Hmm. Speaking of trust, the Israeli government has received extensive domestic and international criticism during the war, including from this editorial page. Now you're an official representative of Israel and sent by the government, but is there any understanding within the Israeli government for the criticism regarding the prevention of food deliveries into Gaza?
There's understanding on our side, and I think there's also understanding in the international community, because if you look, for example, of what the Swedish government has been saying all along, saying that Israel has the right to defend itself within the limits of international law, that all hostages must be released, and that Hamas cannot be part of the solution of the day after. That's something that the international community has been saying all along. When a war goes on, and it's a horrible war, it's not a war that we started, it's not a war that we wanted, and when your enemy is using its civilians as human shields, is using aid. That's what happened. The reason that we had to distribute food directly to the Palestinian people is because Hamas took over the aid. We saw a situation where 85% of the aid that was brought in through the United Nations agencies didn't reach where it was supposed to reach. And in many cases, it reached the terrorists. So obviously, having a situation where a war goes on, a war that we definitely didn't want, is not something that is easy to explain. But I think there is more and more understanding of the importance now of aid not reaching Hamas, but actually reaching the people that are in need of it.
Mm. From my point of view, I had almost hoped, you know, that even giving food as a weapon to Hamas, could that have been avoided by the outer world flooding Gaza with aid? Would that have made a difference? I mean, you don't want Hamas to be able to use food as a weapon.
So aid flooded the Gaza Strip. The last time that happened was in the 42 days of the ceasefire in the end of 24. And what we saw happening is that Hamas became stronger. It was the first time that it was able to pay salaries to its military, recruit tens of thousands of new people, and basically rebuild itself and plan the next October 7th attack. We spoke about the ceasefire. We have to remember that the ceasefire also included the release of 2,000 terrorists from Israeli prisons. Yichya Sinwar was released on a previous deal for one Israeli soldier. Think about 2,000 terrorists. It could be 2,000 planners of the next terrorist attack. So if we talk about aid going in Gaza now, and aid needs to go in, of course it needs to go in, but this aid is going to include cement. It's going to include machinery that is needed to take away all the debris and rebuild the Gaza Strip. If Hamas is still there, and Hamas can abuse the goodwill of the international community that wants to rebuild the Gaza Strip, that wants to develop Palestinian society, this will be the repetition of October 7th massacre and the disaster over and over again.
So the role of the international community now, the most important task would be to see that aid comes into right hands.
Absolutely.
And how do you think that the UN has acted during the war?
We have various issues with the United Nations, in particular one agency. You know, an agency, there's only one case in the world where there's a development, there's a humanitarian aid agency developed, aimed only at one people, one conflict, and that is UNRWA. the development agency for the welfare of the Palestinian people. This was created in 1949, and it continues from generation to generation. And we have seen a systematic abuse of UNRWA by Hamas, people who are Hamas militants, who are on UNRWA's pay list and payroll. And we've also seen UNRWA facilities being abused by terrorists for either hiding in them or building their tunnels underneath them. And that's something that we cannot allow to continue. There are many good UN agencies that do good for the Palestinian people, and we're working with them, but we will not allow a situation where the goodwill of the international community is being abused by Hamas and other terrorist organizations.
So what do you think when you can hear Swedish politicians say that the most important thing is to get UNRWA into the region again?
I think the most important thing is to get aid to the people in need. The aid, you know, like in other crises around the world, the aid can be distributed by the World Food Program, by UNICEF, by WHO. There are plenty of United Nations agencies that operate in every possible corner of the world. Only in the case of the Palestinians, there is UNRWA, which unfortunately throughout the years has become part of the problem and not the solution.
I have a few questions about you. I read an interview with you in QX in December 2021, a few months after you arrived in Stockholm. The introduction was that you are openly gay, you were single, vegetarian, and a big ABBA fan. So my thought was that your profile was cut and ready for progressive Sweden. Almost 4 years later, in the country where you are stationed, you have seen how anti-Semitism has grown exponentially, how there are open tributes to Hamas on Swedish streets and squares, and the Israeli embassy has been subjected to gunfire and several planned attacks have been averted. I think that this posting did not turn out quite as you had thought.
Well, that's a very long and difficult question. So, yeah, not everything worked out the way we plan in life. Let's talk about the things that didn't change. I am still openly gay, unfortunately still single, vegetarian, and very much an ABBA fan. That didn't change. I also still have many friends in the circles that I have just mentioned. But when you talk about progressive, and I say in quotation marks, progressive Sweden, obviously there were lots of disappointments. And when I say lots of disappointments, not only for me personally, but to a lot of my Swedish Jewish friends, people from the so-called progressive circles that I thought would be my closest allies, either from the LGBT community or from cultural communities, academic circles. Many of those people said nothing after October 7th. Many did, but I found a lot of friends who said nothing. And then when I started seeing them or sharing, seeing them on media or sharing things on social media, which was only about the suffering on the other side, I did feel betrayal. And then we have, of course, the question about anti-Semitism, which you have rightfully mentioned, a situation where it has become unsafe for many Jews, many Swedish Jews here in this country and in other places around the world, where the discussion on media or social media has become so toxic that people just feel afraid to express themselves or be open about anything. And that is something that didn't turn out quite the way I planned.
Mm. In Malmö, the Jewish film festival GIF was cancelled in October because no cinemas wanted to rent out their premises, many citing security reasons. However, the festival has since found a new location in Malmö, in central Malmö, and is now planned for spring 26. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, it's great that Malmö has a new new international Jewish film festival, and it's supported by the city, and I believe by the Ministry of Culture as well. So that's good news. I don't know the specific incident and the reason why certain places were available or not available for that festival, but I can share with you some of the experiences that I have here in Stockholm. First of all, anything that happens in the Jewish community right now, whether it is a cultural activity or any kind of community activity, there's so much secrecy about it. There's so many security concerns. There has to be security outside. There have to be super careful about how you register and how you publish an event. So you're basically not making everything public. You don't know where it's going to take place or who exactly is going to participate. All of that is extremely unfortunate and something that didn't exist before October 7th. We also know of cases from the Israeli embassy of cultural organizations. Maybe they don't say it out loud. Maybe they just do it, that they are kind of cautious. Maybe it not necessarily for political reasons. It could be political reasons. It could be just like, well, maybe we shouldn't take any risk. Maybe if we have anything Israeli or Jewish right now, somebody's not going to be happy and we might have some demonstrations or some kind of something controversial. And as a result, people just don't engage. And I think that is extremely dangerous because you start with Israel, you start with something Jewish, and you never know how this is going to end. And when we're talking about organizations, cultural organizations that are actually public organizations and get public support, I think this is something we have to be extremely vigilant about.
Yes, and I've also heard about organizations. They are built upon the experiences of relatives to Holocaust survivors who visit schools to talk about their history. And the schools have now, since October 7, asked them not to come because they don't want to stir any, you know, emotions, creating conflicts.
Yeah, I heard about that from some of my from my Swedish friends here, and even Holocaust survivors who are no longer, or the children of Holocaust survivors who are no longer invited to schools, and that is an alarming phenomena.
It is, and I was during my whole, you know, political life, we've been so taught that we should never forget. We should keep the memory alive of the Holocaust because that tells us something important. So this would be, for me, the opposite, that you say, no, we won't talk about it now.
It's important to engage, and by not talking about things, that is a sort of, that helps Holocaust denial and distortion.
And, I guess that the reason they cancel is because they have fear of conflict, but also because they know that in some parts of, the anti-Israeli movement, there will be a violent capital. And I was wondering, there were two employees of the Israeli embassy that were shot dead outside the Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C. in May. How has that affected your life?
That was a tremendous tragedy, which reminded us that the threat is worldwide. Since October 7th, there's been a dramatic increase in threats, but also in incidents, not only against Israeli embassies or Israeli installations, but also Jewish organizations. And the two employees that were murdered, one of them was Israeli and the other one was Jewish, and it happened outside the Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C., to show you that the people that are threatening us, they categorically accuse all Jews. That is pure anti-Semitism. All Jews are targets. All Jews are legitimate targets in their global jihad. So it's a very sad reminder of the fact that this could happen anywhere. I have to say that we get a lot of assistance. The embassy does, and so does the Jewish community from the local Swedish authorities, who take that very, very, very seriously.
That's good to hear. I have a couple of questions about Swedish politics. My colleague Paulina Neuding interviewed you in May 23, and she asked if the Israeli embassy had contact with the Sweden Democrats. You said that our line is very clear. We do not have contact with the SD or any similar parties in Europe with a clear neo-Nazi background. And she asked you then if you could imagine that there would be a review of this in the long term. And you said that this is our view, and it's a view that has been constant under different Israeli governments. There will be no review of it. But in February this year, Sveriges Radio was able to announce that the Jerusalem Post had reported that Israel was pivoting and wanted to establish relations with the Sweden Democrats. What has happened?
We spoke about the things that didn't change since October 7th, but many things did change. First of all, there was a review in Jerusalem in the foreign ministry about certain political parties, mainly from the populist right in different countries around Europe. So it's not just about the Sweden Democrats, it's about other countries like in Spain or in France. So that was part of a general review. We also have to look at what changed here. If you look at the Sweden Democrats' efforts, ongoing efforts to deal with their past, with anti-Semitism within their own ranks and the way they treated Holocaust survivors. So if you look at if you look at Jimmy Åkesson's speech in Almedalen, if you look at the publication of their white book. Now, it's not up to me. I am not an historian, and I do not represent the Swedish Jewish community. It's really up to them to decide when is time, if to open a new chapter or to discuss relations with the Sweden Democrats. But when it comes to the government I represent and when it comes to Israel, if we look at what happened over the last 2 years with political parties here in Sweden, we have to acknowledge the fact that the Sweden Democrats have been very persistent in their support of Israel and understanding what happened to us on October 7th and the fight that our fight is something that is important to the entire Western world. So that's also something that happens. So you take all of this into consideration, and that can explain the shift.
When you report back home about anti-Semitism in Sweden, what do you say about how the political parties are managing to deal with that development?
So obviously I try to have my reporting as accurate as possible. So if you look at anti-Semitism in Europe and what my reporting is about anti-Semitism in Sweden, you can see that in many cases this is anti-Semitism that its roots comes from people and from that don't come from here. You see that it could be based in other areas, but that's only part of it. You know, to look at it as if it's anti-Semitism is as if somebody is bringing the Middle East conflict to the back doors of Europe or the background of backyards of Sweden. That is not looking at the problem as a whole. It's as if it's saying that, oh, we never had anti-Semitism in Europe. It comes now from other parts of the world. You also have to look at those who are looking into that, who are looking into making political gain from that. You have to look at certain circles who are looking at potential voters, who are also could be for historical reasons have some kind of anti-Semitism background, or a general phenomenon right now of the Israelification of anti-Semitism, basically not accusing Jews, but accusing Israelis or Zionists of things that Jews used to be accused of. So that's part of the phenomenon. You could say that it's a great deal of the phenomenon, but you also have to remember that in this country as well, there are people from the extreme right who celebrate Adolf Hitler's birthday.
Hmm. But would you say in general that the Swedish parties pass or fail?
Some pass and some fail. I think everyone wants to say that they're not anti-Semitic and blame the other side for being more anti-Semitic. That's the easy way out. Some deal with it and some don't. And I think that some parties have very basic problem with understanding definitions of what anti-Semitism is. And I can refer them to the IHRA, to the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, which is a Swedish initiative. And the working definition of an anti-Semitism talks clearly about cases about, you know, double standards when it comes to Israel, demonizing Israel, and accusing Israel of things that no other country is accused of, and also when it comes to self-determination of the Jewish people, basically agreeing with the idea of the right of Israel to exist. A lot of people don't understand that when they call to crush Zionism, that is actually anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and I mean, you will hear a lot of chanting in the streets saying we won't have any Zionists on our streets, basically saying that if your opinion is that the state of Israel should be able to exist, you are not allowed to walk on our streets.
Yeah, and if you are a Swedish Jew who wants to have a Star of David or have an Israeli flag or just have the any kind of connection with the hostages, you're not welcome.
Mm. Have you seen any changes after the ceasefire on that side with the demonstrations?
Yes and no. I mean, I was surprised to still see demonstrations. I don't understand exactly what they are calling for. I mean, they want to stop the genocide. I don't understand what genocide they're talking about. They still want to be out in the streets. That's democracy. I mean, I come from a democracy. I understand that. I just still don't understand exactly what they're asking for.
Hmm. When you think ahead now, do you feel hopeful or discouraged?
In some ways, I feel hopeful because, you know, if we had met just over a month ago, we still had 20 Israeli live hostages that were kept and starved in Hamas tunnels in Gaza. They're back now. I'm optimistic about the ceasefire holding because that's important for the entire region. I'm optimistic about the Abraham Accords enlarging and having more Muslim countries that want to cooperate with Israel. But I also have to think about, as you mentioned here, the streets and trying to heal and rebuild relations with many communities and with many audiences that I wasn't able to have a fruitful dialogue over the last 2 years.
Okay. I just saw picture, a selfie you put on Instagram, and that was the day the hostage was released. Where were you then?
I happened to be in Israel on vacation, and the news of the hostages being released, I, like 500,000 Israelis, flocked Hostage Square, and I was just there when we saw the first images on huge screens of hostages returning back home. So of course I posted myself on social media, and I happened to meet the Middle East correspondent, Jesper Sundén, there. And he asked me a few questions, and he had a photographer, and the photographer asked me if just to pose. And he actually told me that it's okay for me to smile. And this was the first interview I've done in 2 years where I actually, I was allowed and I felt it was appropriate to smile.
Okay, so let's hope that there will be several occasions ahead to feel it appropriate to smile.
Let's hope so.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Ziv Neve-Kullman, for visiting me here today.
Tack så mycket.
Tack till er som har lyssnat på ett avsnitt av Ledarredaktionen. Har ni frågor eller synpunkter kan ni höra av er till ledarsidan@svd.se. Producent för det här avsnittet var Jesper Sandström. Stort tack för idag.